but I need to drink.
Hi, everybody. This is the All Things That Go Bump in the Night podcast. I am Kelly.
And I am Mouse.
So, it's been a week.
It's been a week.
It's been a long fucking week.
I thought this day would never come, guys. Like,
how'd it go?
And it went good. And she's just sitting there questioning me about my depression and anxiety. Well, when was the last time you were on medication? Like, a year ago when I lost my insurance? Well, are you going to get on it again? Yeah, but I've got to wait until my appointment because I have to be there to get prescriptions filled because they won't fill those without an appointment. Mm-hmm. She's like, oh, when can you get in to see him? Well, right now he's booked out for 3 weeks. Why does this matter?
Yeah. Did she say anything about Mickey?
Just that he would benefit from...
counseling?
Yeah, but I told her we're holding off on the counseling until after we move so he doesn't get attached to someone he can open up to just to...
yeah.
Move, and so we're saying things like, you know, we will continue having him go to his primary care physician and getting actual... well, I don't even know how that works, because she wants us to make, like, actual diagnoses for him, and that way when we move, it's all set up, but they can't diagnose until... no, I guess he is old enough now, isn't he?
Yeah. Diagnosed
when
for...
when did that happen?
What are they wanting to diagnose him for?
OCD and ADD.
That's right. Okay.
Because she thinks that's a lot of his behavioral issues.
And... well, that's what I was saying with ODD was that, you know, my cousin had ODD and he was the exact same way. And I see a lot of him in Mickey. So.
Yeah, I guess he is old enough to get the diagnosis now. That sucks. Like, that came out of nowhere.
Tell me about it. Mine's gonna be 11.
This is heartbreaking. Like, why are our babies growing up? I was looking at Izzy today, and it's just, like, dawned on me. She's 2.
Yeah.
I'm like, frick.
Yep.
Kids growing up hurts, guys.
It does. Nate's appointments went well. His scope went very well. A lot of people don't really know, unless you're friends with me. My son has a genetic condition that causes colon cancer. So 2 years ago, we had his colon removed. And they did an ileostomy and a reversal. So they turned the large intestine into a colon, essentially. But he's no longer gaining weight. Even though he eats all the time, he's... 10 years old, and he is only, at his last appointment, he was 52 pounds. And that's very, very low. And so they put him on we think it's from everything, since he doesn't have a colon, everything moves through his system so fast that his body is not absorbing any of the nutrients. So we put him on Imodium 4 times a day to stop him up a little bit, and we're hoping that helps. But he needed another colonoscopy to see how everything was going. And they do a colonoscopy and endoscopy. And
they both suck.
But he gets to sleep through it. Honestly, my biggest worry was not only the results, but how he would do with the IV. Because with him being in the hospital so much with all of his emergency surgeries. And,
yeah,
you know, he had the blood thinners twice a day that I had to give him as a shot. And he doesn't handle needles well at all. And it's been our experience in the past where I've had to literally hold him down to put an IV in because he's allergic to Versed, which is the relaxing medication they give kids. Yeah. He's allergic to Ativan. So it's like we can't give him anything to relax him. And he actually handled it very well. He didn't cry or anything. I mean, he winced. And then he ended up developing a blood clot in the IV, but it was a small one, and we were able to dislodge it with flushing the IV.
Yeah.
But it hurt. His arm hurt. And so when we put him under, we had to go really, really slow, so that way it didn't hurt his veins, because his veins are also super sensitive. They're like mine.
Yeah.
And the doctor said that he has a small bleed in his stomach. They took biopsies to see what the cause of that was. And then But he had no other polyps, no new polyps or anything, which was absolutely fantastic. He said, we don't have to do, unless something were to come up or the biopsy show something, we will not have to do another scope for a few years. That's so good. Yeah, it was.
So what'd they say about the, was it a hemorrhoid or?
No, he said that it was probably a rectal prolapse after all. And if it happens again, I'm to call him and he'll get Nate set up with a specific physical therapist to strengthen his pelvic floor.
Yeah, to strengthen those muscles.
But, I mean, it hasn't happened since...
Well, that's good.
Christmas break, so... Or... What? No, it was before Christmas break. It was Thanksgiving break. Because we were going to Portland the next weekend. Yeah. Yeah. So... All in all, he's good. Just more medications we have to give him. So, but that's fine. The biggest issue now is making sure that he is going, because he has to get it before every meal and before bed. So when he's at school, it's his responsibility to go to the office and take it every day. And he's only been at school for 3 days and he's already missed one day. So.
Kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny, though, because when I was in fourth grade, I had to go to the office a lot when I got really sick. Like, my lymph nodes swole up to the size of golf balls, and they were, like, protruding from my body. And I had to go get my medicine, and I couldn't remember what the doctor said I was there for, because standard procedure, you go there, you say your name, what you need your medicine for, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I need my medicine for my lymph nodes. The school nurse just looked at me and was like, say that again? And, you know, I'm realizing it's like a sense of deja vu. Like, my entire life, people have been saying that to me. And it's like, even when I go out drinking with, like, Eric before, I'd say something and he'd stop and he'd look at me and he's like, what was that? And I'd say it, like, I'll say it because I'm, like, half drunk and I'm like, okay. Like, he just didn't hear me. And then he's like, he'll look at me and be like, what was that again? I usually fall for it about 3 times before I stop, and I'm like, wait a minute. Something's not right here.
Oh.
People like to do that to me. I guess.
Well, I mean, it's because you say some pretty off-the-wall things.
Don't go into my grandpa's basement.
No. Just make sure she does. Make sure my grandpa doesn't get her down to the basement with all his candy. No, okay, so I don't know if we said this in a previous episode, so I used to go and do yard work at Mouse's grandpa's house, and one day I brought my 6-year-old, and he was trying to talk to her and stuff, you know, and she was just kind of looking at him like, are you stupid? Like, she's got her own personality. And I was explaining it to Mouse, and she was like, oh, did he try to get her to go in the basement where all his candy is? And I was like, we were at Allie's birthday party, my daughter's birthday party, in front of family.
In front of her boyfriend's family, and it's like the first time I've met any of them.
And I'm just kind of looking at her, and I'm like, Mouse, rethink that sentence. Listen to that sentence again in your head, and how do you want to say that?
I have no filter, guys. Like, what crosses my brain is what will come out of my mouth.
Like, yeah, it was pretty comical. It's my favorite story. It's my favorite story involving you.
That's why you guys will catch me, like, backtracking or stumbling or stuttering over my words. Because, like, I'll start thinking about what I'm saying halfway through saying it. And I'm like, crap, backtrack.
Yeah, no. So, now every time I see her grandpa, I'm just like... It's in my head.
And now you know about the dating, like, the dating app.
Oh, so my God, yes. Her grandpa.
He's a fun guy.
Oh, my gosh, he's a hoot.
He's a character and a half.
Yes, he is. All right, do we want to get started? Okay, this one's going to be kind of long, so. Okay, so Mouse has no clue what I'm doing today. This was actually requested from Eric, my boyfriend. He You really wanted me to do this episode, and I think you're gonna be excited when you figure it out.
Okay, just as long as we're not.
So, I got my sources from Wikipedia and Carolyn Morrow Long at 64parishes.org. So, Marie Delphine McCarty was born March 19th, 1787, in New Orleans, Louisiana, to Chevalier Louis Barthelemy McCarty and his wife Marie Jean Larrable. Her father's family immigrated from Ireland to America as a boy in 1730. Marie Delphine's family was very prominent and wealthy. Her uncle was the governor of the Spanish-American provinces in Louisiana and Florida from 1785 to 1791. And her cousin was also mayor of New Orleans from 1815 to 1820. When Marie Delphine was 13 years old, she entered into a scandalous affair with a 35-year-old widower, Don Ramon de Lopez y Angula, or Angulo. At the time, he was to assume the position of second-in-command to the Spanish governor. After 6 months of dating, the couple married, but Ramon faced some troubles. The law was that officials overseas were required to get permission from the king before marrying a local. Ramon became impatient, waiting for the marriage license, so he said, "Don't you be Googling this."
No, I'm trying to remember what's her first name, Madame Lalaurie.
Yes, it's Madame Lalaurie.
I'm like sitting here and I'm like, wait a minute, some things are lining up here.
Okay.
So, I was going to look up her first name. I was like, wait a minute.
I was calling her by her very first name, so that way it would, I was hoping it would throw you off.
It did. It threw me for a spin. I was getting ready to go look it up. I was like, wait a minute, this sounds like her.
So, Ramon became impatient waiting for the marriage license, so he cited conscience and honor to persuade the Bishop of Louisiana to perform the ceremony on June 11th, 1800. When King Carlos IV got word, he immediately relieved Ramon of his duties, ordering him back to Madrid, and ordered him to work at a lower-level position in a backwater town. He began writing letters to Spanish officials, blaming his actions on powerful enemies in Louisiana and Spain. As a result, the king pardoned Ramon, appointing him Spanish consul to New Orleans. This position required him to return back to Spain from time to time to appear in court hearings. The first court hearing, he brought pregnant Delphine with him, but as they were passing Havana, Cuba, the ship ran aground. On January 11th, 1805, Ramon died, though the exact cause of his death has never been announced. A few days later, Delphine gave birth to their first daughter, Marie Borja Delphine Lopez y Angula de la Candelaria. You want me to repeat that?
That's a mouthful.
It's a big mouthful. Excuse me, sorry. Marie Borja Delphine Lopez y Angulo de la Candelaria, nicknamed Borquita. The two ended up returning to New Orleans, her and her daughter. In 1807, Delphine married Jean Blanc, who was a prominent banker, merchant, lawyer, legislator, and slave trader.
Wow.
Uh-huh. While married to Delphine, he bought a home at 409 Royal Street that later became known as Villa Blanc. In 1814, Blanc delivered the famous letter from Jean Latif to Governor Claiborne, offering Latif's men to help defend New Orleans against the British in the War of 1812. During her marriage to Blanc, Delphine birthed 3 daughters and 1 son: Marie Lopez Pauline, Louise Marie Lauer, Marie Louise Jean, and Jean Pierre Pauline Blanc.
Wow, why the Marie Louise?
Or Jean. they all. So, in 1815, Jean Blanc, died, leaving Delphine in major debt. Thanks to an inheritance from her father and her own business dealings, she was able to pull herself back out of debt and become a very wealthy woman. In February 1825, 22-year-old middle-class Frenchman, a
In what year?
1825.
Okay.
So in February 1825, 22-year-old middle-class Frenchman, just out of medical school, Dr. Louis Lalaurie, arrived in New Orleans. Fresh off the boat, Louis placed an ad in the Louisiana Courier announcing that he could specialize in straightening crooked backs and correcting other deformities. There are varying reports on how Louis and Delphine met, but the most common one is that she had a crippled child who she enlisted the help of Louis to correct. Delphine's daughter, Pauline, did have a deformity. No, yeah, it was daughter, Pauline. Sorry. I get confused because of all the names are the same. It was their daughter, her daughter, Pauline. She did have a deformity, and letters from Louis's family referred to her as Mademoiselle Blanc, the hunchbacked young lady. When I read that, it just reminded me of The Witcher.
Yennefer. LeBlanc?
No, the hunchbacked lady.
Oh. I thought you said LeBlanc, and I was like, that made me think of the White Witch from The Outlander.
No. No, it was the hunchbacked young lady, Yennefer. She had a massive hunch.
I still haven't watched it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's the very first.
Just catching. I finished up Sabrina, and then I was finishing up iZombie, and then you said something else.
You. Yes. So,
gotta watch You, and then I gotta watch The Witcher, and a couple of movies I want to go see in theaters, so. Like, I want to go see Birds of Prey.
So, despite Louis being characterized as mousy, inconspicuous, and colorless, Delphine found him interesting. By late 1826, Delphine and Louis became intimate, and Delphine became pregnant. At this point, Delphine was 39 years old. On August 13th, 1827, Delphine had son Jean-Louis Lalaurie. According to St. Louis Cathedral marriage and baptism records, the couple married 5 months later on January 12th, 1828. They entered in a contract specifying that Madame Lalaurie would keep control of her personal property, real estate, and slaves, totaling in $67,000. Accounting for inflation, that equals $1,532,688.86.
I wish.
Right? The first years of their marriage, the couple lived at Madame Lalaurie's plantation on the river, but she had developed an eye for a mansion being built on the corner of Royal and Governor Nichols Streets. In 1831, she bought the two plots of land that the mansion was being built on. During this time, the couple was already having problems. They would fight, leave each other, then get back together. This did not end when they moved. In 1832, Delphine petitioned the court for a legal separation, requiring her to stay in the home. She told the courts that Louis was unsupportive and, in the presence of many witnesses, he beat and wounded her in the most outrageous and cruel manner. Yeah. I see that look. So
that was a sly smile, guys.
In 1828, rumors began to circulate about the abuse on her slaves. In 1832, word got out that Delphine had been indicted by a criminal court for abusing her slaves, but was able to clear her name by paying a large sum of money. Even though the criminal court records disappeared for 1828, 1829, and 1832, a document was found from June 22nd, 1829, from her lawyer, John Randolph Grimes, stating that he had received of Madame Lalaurie $300 for my fee for defending the prosecution of the state against her in criminal court. The accounts of the abuse of which her slaves had endured varied. Harriet Martineau wrote in 1838 that while she was in New Orleans, residents told her that Delphine's slaves were seen looking haggard and wretched, but in public, Delphine was seen to be polite to black people and solicitous to her slaves' help. Court records do show that she freed two slaves, Jean-Louis in 1819 and Devance in 1832. Martineau also reported one of Delphine's neighbors saw one of Delphine's slaves fall to her death from the roof of her mansion while being
while trying to avoid punishment from Delphine, who was chasing her with a whip. The young girl had been brushing Delphine's hair when the brush had hit a snag. The girl wound up buried in the mansion's backyard. This was the reason why she was indicted for cruelty to her slaves. As a result, Delphine was ordered to hand over 9 of her slaves. Unfortunately, a relative of Delphine bought the slaves and immediately brought them back to Delphine's mansion. On April 10th, 1834, a fire broke out in the kitchen of the Lollari mansion. On April 11th, those responding found a 70-year-old female slave chained to the stove. She later reported that she was trying to commit suicide. When the responders asked for the key to the slaves' quarters to make sure everyone evacuated, Delphine flat out refused to give them the key. Judge Jacques Francois was the one asking for the key. He reported that Delphine responded to his inquiry, saying very rudely, "There are those who would be better employed if they would attend to their own affairs instead of officiously intermeddling with the concerns of other people." At that point, Judge Francois ordered the other bystanders to break down the door. They were all shocked by what they saw. The scars on all of the slaves that were up there were the least gruesome of their injuries. Some were suspended by their necks, with their limbs stretched and torn from one extremity to the other. One elderly woman had a deep hole in her head, and it's believed that she was using a stick to stir her brains. This is also counting the one woman who was chained to the stove. One woman with an iron collar and her neck around her neck and iron chains by her feet. A man with a large hole in his head with several other wounds from head to toe that were filled with worms. A mulatto boy who reported to have been chained for 5 months, being fed only small amounts and beatings every morning. Males chained to the walls, their eyes gouged out, fingernails pulled off by the roots. Others had their joints skinned and festering great holes in their buttocks where the flesh had been sliced away. Their ears were hanging by shreds and their lips were sewn together. Intestines were pulled out and tied around their waists. One victim had her arms amputated and her skin pulled back in a circular pattern, making her look like a human caterpillar. And another victim had her limbs broken and reset at odd angles so that she looked like a human crab. The slaves were taken to the mayor's office, where they were given medical attention, food, and water. A crowd waited outside the Lollari mansion to watch her get arrested, but no police came. The next day, Delphine's coachman slave, Bastion, came to take Delphine to her property on the river. The crowd was outraged and stormed the empty mansion. They vandalized the mansion so badly that it was essentially just a shell. All that was left up were the walls. Judge Francois testified in court the next day. French consul Armand Salard was there and saw the slaves for himself. He wrote a report to the French Minister of Foreign Affairs about the slaves having dislocated heads, legs torn by chains, and bodies streaked with blood from head to toe, from whiplashes and sharp instruments. He also wrote that when the slaves were brought to the mayor's office, that they were essentially ash gray in color and were barely breathing, most likely from blood loss. Delphine and Louis crossed the river to Mandeville and stayed there only long enough to put their affairs in order and assign power of attorney to their son-in-laws, Placide Forestall and Auguste de Lassus. She did not arrange for any emancipation for a single one of her slaves, not even Bastion, who helped her escape.
So I thought she also had sewn people together.
No, she didn't sew any of them together.
Okay. Could have sworn I read somewhere that she did.
Mm-mm.
Oh, well.
Mm-hmm. From there, Delphine and Louis traveled to New York City. On June 24th, 1834, the couple boarded the ship Poland to travel to France. They also had their son, Jean, with them as well. American poet William Cullen Bryant was also on the ship and wrote about how all the fellow passengers knew of Delphine and treated her so rudely that she was actually often seen in tears. It's the least that she deserves. 3 weeks later, Delphine, Louis, and their son hit land in Le Havre in Paris. There they stayed briefly with Louis's parents, then traveled to Paris, where they met up with her unmarried children, Pauline, Laure, and Pauline Blanc. After a few years, Louis left his wife to travel to Cuba, where he died in 1863. In New Orleans, Placide Forestall sold the Lalaurie mansion for only $14,000. That was less than half of what Delphine had bought the mansion for. He also sold 11 of the 30 slaves that she had owned. The other 19 slaves were unaccounted for, which was very distressing because in those days, slave owners were very meticulous about keeping records of all of their slaves because it was property of them. If you didn't have a record of your slaves, you're essentially not keeping track of your money.
Yeah.
So the rescued slaves in the fire were unable to be sold due to their disabilities caused at the hands of Delphine. While in Paris, Delphine and her children lived a very lavish lifestyle. Placide Forestall had given August de Lassus control over Delphine's business with the responsibility of sending her money. But over time, though, August began saving the money for himself, which meant that Delphine had to start borrowing money to fund her lavish lifestyle. In 1842, Delphine's son, Pauline Blanc, wrote August telling him that she was planning on returning to New Orleans to confront him about where her missing money was. Pauline wrote about how she was becoming more and more cruel towards her own children and how the children were fearful that basically they were worried that if they were to go with her back to New Orleans, to where she was the most cruel, she would basically turn that treatment that she gave to her slaves there on her children. But she never did return. Delphine had a lifelong illness. I couldn't figure out what that was. But she ended up dying on December 7th, 1842, at the age of 62, in her home in Paris. She was originally buried in the cemetery of Montmartre, before being exhumed in 1851 to be buried in New Orleans. Her son Pauline had her buried in the tomb in St. Louis Cemetery No. 1, but there was poor record keeping. The first actual record burial in the Lalaurie family was that of her great-granddaughter who died in 1884. It is believed that Delphine had major mood swings and was mentally ill. It was also believed that when Louis had separated from Delphine, she went off the deep end and took it out on her slaves.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, that kind of lines up just...
It did. So, the original Lalaurie mansion was torn down. Like I said, while excavating the yard, they did find bodies. Remains of a child were found in the condemned well on the property. That was actually thought to be the remains of Leah, the child who jumped from the roof to avoid Delphine's whip after she snagged Delphine's hair with it. So when I first started writing my notes, I was getting a lot of my info off of Wikipedia, which I know Wikipedia is not a very reliable source of research, but this portion of it I got from the 64 Parishes article that I was reading, and it seemed like she was really knowledgeable on the entire history. But, yeah, they believe that the child that was found in the well was Leah, the little girl.
Like, oh no, they found the bodies back then, huh? Mm-hmm. I was gonna say, did they do any, like...
testing?
Yeah, even just based off of, like, the bone structures, like, which ones were African American and which ones were...
Yeah, they... Well, I mean, it was a brand new house.
I would guess.
It was a brand new house. I mean, it was literally still being bought when she bought it.
Yeah.
And the only deaths that we know of... I mean, all of her children lived. Her husband lived. Who else could it be?
This is true.
So, In 1838, the property was bought by Pierre Trastor, who rebuilt it into what it is today Over the years, the building has been used as a public high school, music conservatory, apartment building, a refuge for delinquent children, a bar, a furniture store, and then a luxury apartment building.
I don't know if I'd want to stay in that.
So this is my favorite, little tidbit that I found on this. It's my favorite little fact. In April 2007, Nicolas Cage bought the mansion for $3.45 million. The Nicolas Cage. Why? I don't know. Unfortunately, he had to file for bankruptcy, so on November 13th, 2009, the home was put up for auction. Regions Financial Corporation bought the mansion for $2.3 million. And I know we've got some little tidbits here, in pop culture and stuff that relates to Delphine, but the biggest modern retelling on her was that of Kathy Bates' character in season 3 of American Horror Story. Coven. She was Delphine Lawlery, so.
I could have sworn I'd read somewhere that the Human Centipede movies were based off of her.
I mean, I don't think so.
I know I'm going to have to look that up later, because I swear I read that, but...
She didn't sew any of them together. It might be because she broke their bones and set them the way that she did to make them look like crabs.
Maybe.
And then they just kind of went with it.
That's one way to go with it. I wouldn't have put it past her to try that, honestly.
I wouldn't have either. But, I mean, I've read a lot of articles throughout the years on her, and not a single one of them that I've read did she sew any of them together. But, yeah. So that was Madame Lalari.
Yeah, it's like that first paragraph. I'm sitting there and I'm like, wait a minute.
All right, so what's your topic?
Today I'm going to be talking about Matthew Shepard. So, a lot of you may remember him, and for those who are younger, he died when we were children.
Okay.
Well, he was murdered.
Okay, is this here in Spokane?
No, it was in... Oh gosh, it was in Wyoming, wasn't it? Yeah, I'm pretty... Yeah.
Okay.
So his full name is Matthew Wayne Shepard. He was born December 1st, 1976 in Casper, Wyoming. So okay. He was born in Wyoming. He died in Colorado. Yeah.
Okay.
Died October 12th, 1998, Fort Collins, Colorado. He was an American college student who was severely beaten because of his sexual orientation and was left to die in 1998. He was discovered and hospitalized, though he succumbed to his injuries. His death, which was evidence of physical danger that homosexuals still sometimes faced in the United States, played a key role in the 2009 passage of legislation that expanded federal hate crime laws to include violence committed because of sexual orientation of the victim.
Okay.
So that's just like a little beginner snippet. Shepard's father was an oil rig inspector who worked in Saudi Arabia. Matthew attended high school in Casper, Wyoming, and the American School of Switzerland before enrolling at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, where he studied foreign relations, languages, and political sciences. On campus, Shepard had been open about his sexuality, and he was involved in the university's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender student association. So this was before they added the Q.
Okay, so he was...
So this was a while ago.
Okay, so this was the LGBT...
Yeah.
Commission or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shepard's death attracted widespread attention, not only in the small town of Laramie, which had a population of fewer than 30,000, but also across the country and around the world. Although federal laws at the time covered hate crimes based on race, color, religion, and national origin, none included sexuality or sexual orientation. In 1998, Wyoming was one of the 10 states that had no hate crime laws to protect specific categories of people. Shepherd's death was cited by figures within the gay rights movement as clear-cut evidence of the need for more expansive federal hate crime legislation. In 2007, Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act, later dubbed the Matthew Shepherd Act, was introduced to address these shortcomings in the law. Although the bill was passed in the U.S. House of Representatives, it was delayed because of widespread Republican opposition.
Of course.
Including former, I don't know what I said from, but former U.S. President George W. Bush, who threatened to veto it. In 2009, a modified version of the bill was finally approved by both the House and the Senate. Later that year, U.S. President Barack Obama signed the legislation, which was officially known as the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009.
Okay.
So the horrific killing of Matthew Shepard in 1998 is widely seen as one of the worst anti-gay hate crimes in American history. Matthew was beaten by two assailants, Aaron McKinley and Russell Henderson. They pistol-whipped him with a gun, then tied him to a fence in freezing conditions and set him on fire before leaving him to die. The men responsible for his death were convicted of first-degree murder and given two life sentences. They were not charged with a hate crime, as that wasn't possible under Wyoming's criminal law. On the evening of October 6, 1998, Matthew went to the Fireside Bar and local hangout that was reportedly gay-friendly. It was karaoke night, and locals rubbed shoulders with workers calling in for a swift drink on their way home. Shortly afterwards, Russell Henderson and Eric McKinley arrived. The three men chatted briefly before leaving the bar and getting in a truck belonging to McKinley's father. McKinley's father. So, what's really interesting, most of the research that I did, a lot of it doesn't report that. Maybe it's because the assailants denied knowing him for so long during the confessions and all that, but they did actually know each other. Okay. It wasn't random. They did know each other.
So they knew that he was gay.
Yeah. In the truck, Matthew was robbed of his keys, wallet, and shoes, and beaten repeatedly by one or both of the men. He was then taken from the truck, pistol-whipped up to 18 times on the head, and kicked between the legs. Matthew was tied to a fence, set on fire, and left unconscious. 15 hours after he had the attack, student Aaron Kreifels was out riding his bike when he discovered Matthew tied to the fence, barely alive. He initially mistook him for a scarecrow, or like a Halloween costume, but he realized the guy was alive.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly.
Yeah, like, I can't imagine after all of that in freezing, because I have family in Wyoming, so I know how the weather is there.
Yeah.
And add on top of that, being burned alive, like, you don't normally survive that.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard about this case, I was in 7th grade, mm-hmm. and one of the our history teacher, I don't know how she got away with covering, like, teaching this in the syllabus, because she showed us videos of the first responder showing up and, like, the first responder who did CPR and then had to later be tested because she came in contact with his blood and he had AIDS.
Oh, he had AIDS?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. But, I mean, you went to school in District 81, so, I mean...
They gave us the crash course.
They let me keep my hydrocodone on me and leave my class to take it, like, when I broke my elbow. So.
They let me keep pain medicine, too, and then tried to say I was trying to sell and distribute it. So, they're crazy, guys.
Yeah.
Where was I?
It's where all the troubled kids go.
It's true.
It really is true.
So, Matthew's face was covered in blood, aside from tear tracks on each side of his cheeks. The first officer at the scene was Reggie Flutie. The only thing I could see was partially somebody's feet, and I got out of my vehicle and raced over, said Flutie. These are all quotes, so I'm sorry here. This is her language. I seen what happened to be a young man, 13, 14 years old, because he was so tiny, laying on his back. He was tied to the bottom end of a pole. I did the best I could. After leaving, Matthew tied And that's not all she had to say, so there's more later that I'll tell you from quoted by her. After leaving, Matthew tied to the fence. McKinley and Henderson headed for Matthew's home, but on the way encountered two young Hispanic men. I worded that weird. They didn't leave him there alone. Like, other first responders had shown up, but they had went to go look for any sort of indicators that could lead to what was going on. On the way, they encountered two young Hispanic men, Emiliano Morales and Jeremy Herrera, slashing tires for fun. The men got into a fight, resulting in McKinney cracking open Morales' head with the same gun he had used on Matthew. Police officer Flint Waters arrived, grabbed Henderson. He and McKinley had run in different directions and found the truck, the gun, Matthew's shoes, and credit card. 5 days after the attack on October 12th, Matthew died. The day Matthew died, President Clinton told journalists at the White House, "In our shock and grief, one thing must remain clear. Hate and prejudice are not American values." The funeral was attended by more than 1,000 mourners and picketed by the Westboro Baptist Church, led by the Fred Phelps asshole.
Mm-hmm.
A defrocked minister who founded GodHatesFags.com.
Yep.
To counter the protest, Matthew's friends dressed as angels and wore huge bedsheets with poles underneath to obstruct the view and hatred that the Westboro Baptist Church was spewing.
Good.
And that, in turn, like, prompted a lot of movies and short films and, like, stage plays and a whole bunch of stuff. And the angels themselves trying to block out that hatred.
That's amazing.
Yeah, like, I was totally shocked when I found out the Westboro Baptist Church was coming here to Spokane. Like, I was in college, so 2011, and I was like, what are they doing here?
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense now that I look around and see house.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was at my client's house today, and was it today? Yesterday. And a news report came on, and it was like a preview of what to expect on the news tonight, and it was about this guy who constantly pickets Planned Parenthood here in Spokane. Fucking hate him. And he's a murderer.
Yeah, the guy who leads it?
Yeah. I've checked his Facebook because I wanted to see for myself, and he literally spews nothing but hate.
Yeah, and it's assholes like that
that have made it. Our Planned Parenthoods don't even perform abortions.
No, and it's assholes like that have made my role necessary in a lot of my friends' lives. Like, all throughout high school, I was the one designated where people are like, hey, I need to go to Planned Parenthood to get pills, but I'm too scared to go alone. One of my friend Amanda wanted to go get a pregnancy test and get some other, like, HIV testing done because she thought her boyfriend gave her some diseases. And she was too scared to go alone, so I had to walk her in. My own mom wouldn't go in there. She will not go in there. Like, she's...
Really?
She's terrified. And so I went in there for her because her coworkers were engaging in unsafe sex with strange men in bars. And my mom wanted them to be safe, so she wanted condoms. But she's not about to go fork out, like, $80 for a bunch of condoms for these girls. So I went in with, like, $20 for a donation, and I asked for a bag of condoms.
Mm-hmm.
That way my mom could have a bunch of condoms for them. And it's just like...
When I...
You know some shit's really messed up. I'm like, sorry guys for my language, but this pisses me off. These people, what they do, and, like, how they harass people is not okay.
When I found out that I was pregnant with Nate, you know, I was 16, 17. I was still a kid. And I was too scared to tell my mom. I took a pregnancy test at home, but I went to Planned Parenthood to get it confirmed. And just the amount, like, now the Planned Parenthood out here in the Valley is completely different. But the one that I went to, they had, like, you had to go through 3 separate doors. You had to show your ID to get in. You had to, like, there was surveillance everywhere because of bomb threats and stuff. And I'm like,
oh, yeah.
This is news to me. Like, I had no clue that this was something...
Yeah, the one out here in the Valley is really lax. The one downtown where they protest all the time is not.
And the one on
South Hill. And that's the one I always had to go to because it's where we lived. And that's where all the kids went to school around. And they have, like, you have to give them your ID, and you have to, like, go through little checkpoints with security guards, armed security guards. Like, how is this still an issue? How is any of this? And, like...
And our Planned Parenthoods don't even perform abortions.
No.
Your doctor, I can guarantee, performs more abortions than your Planned Parenthood does.
Yeah, it's
if ridiculous. It weren't for Planned Parenthood, we would not have caught my cervical cancer. Like,
yeah, it is really ridiculous, guys. Like, the issues with women's bodily rights, and like these are like the same sort of people who showed up at this funeral, and they show up at soldiers' funerals, and they say God wanted you dead.
Yeah,
and they're horrible people.
They are. They're and truly horrible.
I just don't know how they're still around.
I don't either.
So, after that, like, I can only do so much, but there. So, I've got the timeline of events here, because, you know, timelines tell a better story than I can from anger, and you don't treat feelings. People like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, writing this and researching it, I was sitting there, and I was, like, choking up a lot, and I was like, don't cry, you got this. Like, I don't handle things like this very well, guys.
That's how it was when I did Casey Anthony.
I'm a very angry person, and stuff like this makes me so angry that I start crying. Like, how do people treat other people like this? So, December 1st, 1976, Matthew Shepard is born. Shepard, age 15, is arrested for sexually assaulting 2 8-year-old boys in Casper. Yeah.
Oh.
Like, there's a lot in here that goes both ways.
Oh my.
Like, both ways. It depicts him as the angel and as the devil.
Like, I mean...
And it gets a lot more, because this is where another book was released, I'll get to that later, saying, you know, this happened and this happened, but he wasn't a victim in all of it. Like, no. A lot of it, he was the villain.
Yeah. I mean, if you're gonna go after children, I'm sorry. That's where I lose all...
The Shepherd family moves to Saudi Arabia. Matthew enrolls in boarding school in Lugano, Switzerland for his last 2 years of high school. So that was following the charges.
Okay.
Marrakesh, Morocco, on a senior trip with other students from his boarding school, Matthew is attacked by a gang of young men and raped 6 times and robbed. Fall 1995, Shepherd enrolls at Catawba College in North Carolina. 1996, Shepherd meets Ted Henson in Saudi Arabia. They grow to become close friends and lovers. And that also comes up later, his name. Okay. June 1996, Matthew is treated for depression and other symptoms in North Carolina. Late June 1997, Shepherd and McKinney, through mutual friends Doc O'Connor, meet for the first time at a Denver gay bar. Doc O'Connor runs a... male prostitute ring.
Okay. So was he a male prostitute then, too?
Yes. And a drug dealer.
Oh.
And McKinney, the one of the guys who killed him, was a new drug addict and got in to support his habit, met Doc O'Connor, and became a male escort.
Okay.
And that's how they met.
Okay.
So, summer 1997 to summer 1998. Shepherd lives in Denver. He gets hooked on crystal meth and cocaine and adopts a fast lifestyle. By the end of his time in Denver, Shepherd is enmeshed in the drug trade, primarily dealing meth. McKinney, meanwhile, becomes a heavy drug user. He earns money and feeds his drug habit through work as a male escort for a gay clientele through of Doc O'Connor's escort service. December 17th, 1997. Aaron McKinney, 20, and 2 others burglarize a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant in Laramie, stealing $2,500 and some desserts.
Well, you gotta get some desserts to go with that money.
Right?
Got your priorities right there.
Okay, so
you're gonna steal money, make it worth it.
Yeah, I'm right here. May 9th, 1998, a car goes up in flames in Laramie neighborhood around 4 a.m. Police find Shepherd, among others, at the scene and interview him. The police report notes inconsistencies in Shepherd's account of what he had been doing and described him as very excited speaking rapidly and wide-eyed.
AKA he was high.
Yep. Spring 1998. McKinney is held at the Albany County Detention Center awaiting trial on burglary charges, released June 11th. Summer 1998. McKinney and his girlfriend, Kristen, and their infant son live in a trailer on the property of Doc O'Connor and, of Thomas's. So Doc. I'm just going to call him the Doc. It's easier. in Wyoming. McKinney becomes friends with Russell Henderson, who he works with on roofing jobs. Henderson is introduced to meth. August 19th, 1998, near Cody, Wyoming, Shepard's sexual overtures toward a man lead him to lose his temper and punch Matthew, breaking his jaw. Oof. August or September 1998, doesn't say. Shepard and McKinney smoke a bowl of meth together in a parked car. McKinney, according to friends of Shepard's, comes back from the encounter angry at Shepard, apparently because he'd turned down a business proposal, drug deal, perhaps, refusing to give McKinney meth without cash payment up front. So there's another cause for anger right there.
Mm-hmm.
Won't give him free drugs.
Mm-hmm.
September 1998, McKinney encounters Shepard at Laramie convenience store. According to Shepard's friend, McKinney yells at Shepard and tells him, "You better watch your back." October 2nd, 1998, Shepard hires Doc O'Connor to take him and a friend, Tina Liberi, to the Tornado, a gay nightclub in Fort Collins, in O'Connor's limousine. So, Doc.
Mm-hmm.
Shepard enjoys dancing, but later seems depressed. Shepard spends about $1,100 over the course of the night. After spending hours in the club, the group has a late-night dinner at a Denny's. Always a Denny's.
Of course.
I'm guilty of that, too, guys.
I know. When Jared was in town.
Yep. Straight to Denny's afterwards. On the limo ride back to Laramie, Shepard expresses suicidal thoughts. So Liberi chooses to spend the night with him at his apartment.
Sounds like he's coming down is what it is.
Yeah. October 2nd to 6th, 1998. McKinney is on a hardcore meth cocaine binge daily. October 3rd, 1998. Matthew calls his mother, cries uncontrollably, has a panic attack, takes about 15 anti-anxiety pills. That afternoon, Shepard meets with a dealer with a tough reputation at the Fireside Lounge. McKinney, according to a report by a friend, owes the dealer money. According to one source, about $1,200. October 4th, 1998. Shepard calls Tina Liberi from a bar and asks her to join him. Liberi later describes his mood that day as pensive and worried. After Liberi leaves, Matthew meets Doc O'Connor at the Eagles Club and spends several hours talking with Shepard. Shepard reveals that he has AIDS and is depressed about it. October 5th, 1998. In the early evening, Shepard is driven to a grocery store by a friend, Tina Liberi, to pick up cold medicine. The two return to Shepard's apartment and watch television. October 6th, 1998. In the early morning, out of money and almost out of drugs, McKinney breaks into the home of his cousin. He goes to work at his roofing job. After work, McKinney meets Ken Hasselhun, who promises to hook him up later that evening with a dealer who has 6 ounces of meth. McKinney says later he planned to rob the dealer and Ken at gunpoint. McKinney, Henderson, and Hasselhun drive to the home of the dealer, but he's not there. They visit the residence of a second dealer, who also was not home. McKinney drops off Hasselhun, though he will return to the house later. They stop briefly by McKinney's apartment, visit Henderson's trailer, where he shows and changes clothes, and then the two men go to the library bar around 10 p.m., They continue to check out whether a dealer has returned home. After a few drinks, they leave to go to the Fireside Bar. They get to the Fireside sometime around 11:30 p.m. and sit down on the stools at the bar, about 4 or 5 seats from where Shepard is sitting. October 6th, 1998. Shepard is scheduled to make a drug run to Denver. He's supposed to pick up 12 ounces of meth, drop off 6 in Fort Collins, and return to Laramie with the remaining 6 ounces in the afternoon. Shepard calls Doc from a bar to ask about renting a limo around 9:30 for a night out with friends. Shepard remains in the library bar until 6 or 6:30. He goes to a meeting of the campus LGBT. After the meeting, the group gathers at the Village Inn. Shepard is dropped off at the apartment about 9 p.m. About 10 p.m., Shepard drives his Ford Bronco to the Fireside Bar, where it is karaoke night. He takes a seat at the bar, has a few drinks, he moves to a table where another patron is sitting and says something about not wanting to be near the assholes, presumably McKinney and Henderson at the bar. According to the patron, Mike St. Clair, Shepard hits on him. Early morning, October 7th, 1998. Shortly after midnight at the Fireside Bar, McKinney walks over to the bar where Shepard and St. Clair are seated. McKinney bums a cigarette from Shepard. They exchange a few words, and the two men get up and walk to the Fireside bathroom. Sometime, most likely between 12:15 and 12:30, McKinney, Shepard, and Henderson leave the bar together. The three men get into a pickup with Henderson driving. They head off to the east. A few minutes later, McKinney begins to beat Shepard with his gun. Shepard hands over his wallet, but the beating continues. They stop on a dirt road. McKinney pulls Shepard from the vehicle. Henderson, as ordered by McKinney, ties up Shepard with a rope. He is lashed to a rail fence. Henderson asks McKinney to stop the beating, and McKinney responds, striking Henderson in the face with his gun. McKinney delivers a final violent blow, rendering Shepard unconscious, and McKinney and Henderson drive off. A few minutes later, McKinney and Henderson, they don't mention the fire, get into a fight with two vandals on North 6th Street. Police suspect McKinney and Henderson to be the actual vandals, pull up behind their truck. Both men take off, but Henderson is caught. Police soon notice McKinney's gun with blood all over it. Later, October 7th, 1998. Russell Henderson receives 9 stitches in a Laramie emergency room as a result of the blow from McKinney. Around 6 p.m., a cyclist falls off his bike and sees Shepard unconscious and severely injured. He calls for help. Shepard's taken to the emergency room of Laramie Hospital, then transferred by ambulance to a hospital in Fort Collins. McKinney is read the Miranda rights and interviewed by police, but says nothing about Shepard. McKinney, Henderson, and their girlfriends concoct an alibi and dispose of their drugs. So the alibi was that they didn't know him and that they felt threatened because he was gay and hitting on them, and they knew they could get away with a hate crime at the time.
Wow.
October 8th, 1998. Police question Henderson, his girlfriend, Chastity Paisley, and McKinney's girlfriend, Kristen Price. Stories change, some facts come out about the beating. At 11:30 p.m., McKinney is arrested and charged with attempted murder. October 9th, 1998. McKinney confesses to the killing of Matthew Shepard in his statement to police. McKinney claims that Shepard had offered drugs in exchange for sex. He also admits to having been involved with meth, but denies any recent use of the drug at a press conference. The county sheriff suggests that Shepard might have been beaten because he was gay. The press begins to call what happened a suspected hate crime. McKinney, Henderson, and their two girlfriends are arraigned. The Shepherds arrive at Fort Collins to see their brain-dead son. President Clinton calls the hospital to express his support. October 12th. Okay, I'm starting to get choked up, guys. Sorry. Even if he wasn't that great of a person, I still don't like this sports stuff. October 12th, 1998, 12:53 a.m., Matthew Shepard dies. Memorial gatherings are held around the county. The charges against McKinney and Henderson are changed to first-degree murder. October 14th, 1998. President Clinton urges Congress to pass a federal hate crime bill. Several thousand people stage a candlelight vigil on the Capitol steps. October 16th, 1998. A funeral service is held for Shepard and Casper. April 5th, 1999. In order to avoid the death penalty, Henderson pleads guilty to murder and kidnapping charges at a court hearing. Henderson tells Shepard's parents, "I regret greatly what I did." Henderson is sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms, making the possibility of parole unlikely. A week later, Henderson is taken to the state penitentiary in Rawlins. October 25th, 1999. Opening statements are delivered at the trial of Aaron McKinney. November 1st, 1999. Judge Voight rules that the jury must ignore gay panic. Evidence presented by the defense. November 3rd, 1999. McKinney is convicted of kidnapping, aggravated robbery, and second-degree murder. November 4th, 1999. Rather than proceed with the sentencing phase of the trial, in which the death penalty would be an option for jurors, McKinney agrees to accept life without parole and with no possibility of appeal of his conviction. July 2004, Elizabeth Vargas for ABC's show 2020 interviews McKinley at High Desert State Prison in Nevada. When it airs later, the show suggests that the murder of Matthew had more to do with money and drugs than the fact that Shepard was gay.
Sounds like it to me.
2009, Judy Shepard, Matthew's mother, Matthew's mother published the book The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie, and A World Transformed. October 28, 2009, President Obama signs the Matthew Shepard Act, making assaults based on characteristics that include sexual orientation a crime. October 2013, Jimenez, she knows better, publishes the book, The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard. That's another part I'm covering here after this, which is extensively researched. He interviewed 112 named sources, in addition to a number of others who refused to be named. Presents evidence that the murder of Shepard was about drugs and money, not Matthew's orientation. October 26, 2018. Shepard's ashes are interred at the crypt of Washington National Cathedral. The autopsy of Matthew Shepard is released. The former Albany County coroner, Julie Hagee, who performed the autopsy, tells reporters the hand-shaped bruises in Shepard's groin area convinced her that the murder was a hate crime. So, now I'm going to go to the book that I just mentioned, because it took him 13 years.
Wow.
To do all of his research.
Well, I mean, he researched over 112 people.
Yeah. And that's just the named ones.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, that's why I said over 112 people.
So, that... let's see. There's my stars. So, after all these years, another version of the story has come to light by the author, Stephen. I'm just going to call him Stephen
because it's
easier for me. I'm going to be reading parts of that article that include snippets of the interviews and from the case, and that's written by The Guardian.
Okay.
Oh, wait. I still need that. A new twist came recently with the publication of the book. This one was investigated by the journalist...
Stephen Jimenez.
I'm repeating myself a lot. Sorry, guys. Who has spent 13 years interviewing more than 100 people with connections to the case. His conclusion outlined in the book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard, is that the grotesque murder was not a hate crime, but could instead be blamed on crystal meth, a drug that was flooding Denver and the surrounding area at the time of Matthew's death. This new theory has understandably caused a lot of anger, and you know, it does also make sense because at the time, the gay community was really, they were all still a lot in the closet, and yeah. Those who weren't generally
very
in the scene, that's what yes. We're gonna go with in the yes. Scene, so it also makes proud. Quite a bit sense. Jimenez has faced a barrage of criticism since the publication of his book and has readings to promote the book boycotted. He claims, however, that many of his critics have not actually read it. They're just more angry that
they're saying that
they're discredit what he the way he defines it is it's discrediting
the LGBT fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's trying to make it seem like there was no problem with the LGBT if it weren't for this case.
And what others have said who've read the book was that no, it's not like that at all. It's just he wants to bring light to what really happened.
Exactly.
The Advocate, America's leading LGBT magazine, published a piece it wasn't last year. Since this was an article by them, it was actually a few years ago. entitled Why I'm Not Reading the Truthism About Matt Shepard. Jimenez has been accused of being a revisionist, a criticism usually reserved for extreme right-wing ideologues that deny Holocaust and labeled a homophobe. For people object to the idea of the book rather than what is in the book, says Jimenez. The anger directed at me has been pretty extreme. Jimenez had no intention of causing such controversy. He's an award-winning writer and TV producer, and visited Laramie shortly after the murder to gather material for a screenplay about the case. When he started, he was convinced that Matthew died at the hands of homophobes, but he soon discovered that Matthew's tragedy began long before the night he was killed. He found that Matthew was addicted to and dealing crystal meth and had dabbled in heroin. He also took significant sexual risks and was being pimped out alongside Aaron McKinney, one of his killers, with whom he'd had occasional sexual encounters.
So he couldn't have, well, I can't say that. That's not true. You can still, a lot of the biggest, like, homophobes are men who are afraid to admit that they're gay.
Yeah, like, he's the one who went to the bathroom with him for, like, 30 minutes before they left.
Yeah.
So, you can only assume that what it was happened. Drugs and...
Yeah.
Drugs and sex.
Yeah.
Men don't do potty parties.
They really don't. That's a girl thing, guys. He was HIV positive at the time of his death. This does not make the perfect poster boy for the gay rights movement, says Jimenez, which is part of the reason my book has been so trashed. Matthew's drug abuse and the fact that he knew one of his killers prior to the attack was never explored in court. Neither was the rumor that the killers knew that he had access to a shipment of crystal meth in the street value of $10,000, which they wanted to steal. Matthew was born into an affluent... Okay, so, which they wanted to steal. I also forgot to cover that earlier. They knew about it. They wanted to steal it. So that's where they were headed after they tied him up and left him. They were heading to his house to get that.
Okay.
And that's when they got into a fight and got caught.
Okay.
Matthew was born into an affluent family and had attended state school in Casper, Wyoming, before all the other schools
yeah.
had all the issues. The 21-year-old political science major at Laramie University stood only 5'2", and his blonde hair, braces, and slight frame gave him an air of vulnerability and innocence.
And his which I'm sure really worked for him.
Yeah.
As an escort.
Yeah, they really probably did.
I mean...
Small, cute, adorable, and there to do whatever you say.
Exactly, which is really, really sick in my eyes.
Yeah. In his junior year of high school, Matthew moved with his family to Saudi Arabia. There were no American high schools in Saudi at the time, so he was sent to the American school in Switzerland. By the time he enrolled at Laramie, he spoke 3 languages and had aspirations to be a human rights advocate. Somewhere along the line, however, Matthew fell from being a grade A student to a drug-addicted prostitute who diced with danger. He suffered periods of depression, possibly as a result of being gang-raped a few years earlier while on holiday in Morocco.
I'm sure that had a big part in it.
But this is not the Matthew Shepard who became a celebrated figure for the gay rights movement in America. Laramie is considered the most liberal town in Wyoming, and it sits in a flat, treeless sweep of high plains, with ranching industry in decline. Employment here is dominated by the University of Wyoming. It has a quaint western charm, tree-lined streets, beautiful parks, and renovated historic downtown at the edge of the railway yard, with small shops and restaurants. It really is a beautiful town. I've been there. It is very pretty.
Oh, I know.
It is surrounded by rolling prairies, ranches, the snowy mountain range, and vast wide open spaces. But the town also has a number of mobile home parks at the edges that are pretty run down and running rampant with drug addicts and prostitutes and all the wrong sorts.
Yes. The bad apples.
There we go. I was trying to find a way to
make it not sound as
bad as
crude.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first officer at the scene, this was also another... So a lot of people quote her. Reggie Flutie, the woman who... The first responder. The only thing I could see was partially somebody's feet, and I got out of my vehicle and raced over, said Flutie. Her short blonde hair, fringe, and wire-rimmed glasses making her appear more like a social worker than a police officer. I seen what appeared to be a young man, 13, maybe 14 years old, because he was so tiny, laying on his back, and he was tied to the bottom end of a pole. I did the best I could.
That had to have killed her.
Yeah. And then, not only that, but going home to, like, your 3-year-old and your 5-year-old and being scared to hug them because she was told not to have contact with anyone until she received the end of her, like, testing to make sure she didn't have AIDS.
Yeah.
After leaving, Matthew tied to the fence, McKinney and Henderson headed for Matthew's home. There we go. See, they said it.
Yeah.
I didn't. They headed to his home, but on the way encountered Emiliano Morales and Jeremy Herrera slashing tires for fun. The men got into a fight, resulting in McKinney cracking open Morales' head with the same gun he'd used on Matthew. Officer Flint Waters arrived, grabbed Henderson, and they ran in different directions, found the truck, found the shoes, found the credit card. I spoke to Waters, who has since retired from the police, having seen him praise the book of Matt on social media. I believe to this day that McKinney and Henderson were trying to find Matthew's house so they could steal his drugs. It was fairly well known in the Laramie community that McKinney wouldn't be one that was striking out of a sense of homophobia, which makes sense if he's a male escort.
Yeah.
Some of the officers I worked with had caught him in a sexual act with another man, so it didn't fit. None of that made any sense to us. But when Matthew's friends Walt Bolden and Alex Trout heard the attack, they rushed to the hospital. This is where things blew up. They contacted the Associated Press and a number of local gay organizations that same day.
Of course.
To blow it up.
Yep.
Bolden, which I really feel like would have hindered the investigation.
You would think.
Well, it probably did, based off of all the facts that came out afterwards.
Yeah.
A 46-year-old college instructor who says he was the last person to talk to Matthew before he met McKinney and Anderson at the bar linked the attack to Wyoming legislators' failure to pass hate crimes bills. So it really sounds like they're just using him.
They were.
Bolden later said that the assault was identified as a hate crime by a policeman. Jimenez is an award-winning journalist and gay man. So why has he put such time and effort into attempting to prove that Matthew's murder was not a hate crime, especially as it has seen him accused of being an ally to the right-wing Christian fundamentalists who deny the reality of homophobia?
Yeah.
The view was that homophobic rednecks walked into a bar, saw an obviously gay man with money, and targeted him and beat him to death for that reason, said Jimenez. But that isn't what happened at all. Nothing in this book takes away from the inequity and brutality of the crime, of the culpability of his murders. But we owe Matthew and other young men like him the truth.
Yes.
Aaron and Matthew had a friendship. They'd been involved sexually. They bought and sold drugs from each other. That complicates the original story of two strangers walking into a bar and targeting Matthew. Someone they didn't know. Because he was gay. Although McKinney has never acknowledged that he knew Matthew, Jimenez found a dozen sources that had seen them together. One is Kathleen Johnson, the former owner of Laramie Antique Store, Granny's Attic, who knew Henderson, McKinney, and Matthew. The young, unemployed men had not had easy lives. Henderson's mother was a chronic alcoholic who had been repeatedly beaten by his father. McKinney had spent much of his childhood alone, left by his mother with his grandparents, who locked him in the basement to keep him out of trouble. Russell Henderson used to hang around with gay people, Johnson told me. Laramie had a big gay population. I knew what people's sexual orientation was because my best friend's son was gay. I saw them hanging around with Russell. The police did not investigate the killer's relationship to the gay community. 5 days after the attack on October 12th, Matthew died. On October 14th, a celebrity vigil was held on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, attended by the likes of Ted Kennedy, Ellen DeGeneres, Elton John sent flowers to Matt's funeral, Barbara Streisand telephoned the Albany County Sheriff's Office to demand quick action to the case, and Madonna called an assistant to university president Philip DuBois to complain about what happened. The day Matthew died, President Clinton told journalists at the White House, "In our shock and grief, one thing must remain clear. Hate and prejudice are not American values." The funeral was attended by more than 1,000 mourners and picketed by the Westboro Baptist Church, led by Fred Phelps, a defrocked minister and founder of GodHatesBags.com. To counter-protest, Matthew's friends dressed as angels. Joanne Wipjewski.
You're on your own on that one.
Wipjewski. That's what I'm going with, guys. An author and former senior editor at The Nation was one of the many journalists who came to Laramie after the news of Matthew's attack. She was there for Harper's Magazine and was the only journalist to suggest early on that methamphetamine may have played a role in Matthew's death. The case was used to highlight the fact of violence against gay people. I'm just going to call her Joanne. Joanne told me, "Hate crime legislation under Clinton includes provisions for race and enhanced penalties for crimes against women. These were used as sweeteners to those on the left. They were likely the identity politics of criminal law. This is what gave some other groups the idea about hate crime legislation was a good thing." Joanne thinks the reason... I keep trying to say it.
You are struggling so bad.
Joanne thinks the reason some sections of the gay community are so angry about the Jimenez book is obvious. Jimenez has taken away their angel, and there is the reflexive sense that, as a community, its suffering was being at last recognized, and that people shaping the news require a very simple story. They have to be angels, and there has to be villains.
Okay.
John Stoltenberg is a gay right activist who lived with feminist writer Andrea Dworkin until her death in 2005. He's a longtime supporter of the Laramie Project, but has also blogged positively about the Book of Matt, keeping Matthew as a poster boy of gay hate crime and ignoring the full tragedy of his story has been the agenda of many gay movement leaders. He says, "Ignoring the tragedies of Matthew's life prior to his murder will do nothing to help other young men in our community who are sold for sex, ravaged by drugs, and generally exploited. They will remain invisible and lost." Ted Henson is a former lover and long-term friend of Matthew's. The pair originally met when Matt was growing up in Saudi Arabia. Henson told me he believes that the Book of Matt is nothing more than the truth, and that he was never certain that the murder was an anti-gay hate crime anyways. "I don't know why there's so much hostility towards Steve," he told me. "Matt would not have wanted to be seen as a martyr, but would have wanted the truth to come out." Other Laramie residents believe there's another form of prejudice at work in the way Matthew's story has been told, one that concerns the oft-repeated notion that Wyoming is full of gay-hating bigots. Ray Hageman reported in the case for Wyoming Radio in 1998, and was always skeptical of the media construction of the story. National media couldn't resist a narrative that fits with its preconceived notions about people in rural western states, Hageman told me. "You know, it's simple folks with a piece of straw hanging from our mouths, spitting tobacco, and shooting pop cans from the front porch. The folks of Laramie just had to take it because a fellow who happened to be gay was murdered in their town." The Matthew Shepard Foundation stands firm about the murder being fueled by homophobic hatred. "I asked for a reaction regarding the book, but was sent a pre-prepared statement by Executive Director Jason Marsden, who was a friend of Matthew's. We do not respond to innuendo, rumor, or conspiracy theories," read the statement first issued when the Book of Matt was published. "Instead, we remain committed to honoring Matthew's memory and refuse to be intimidated by those who seek to tarnish it. We owe that to tens of thousands of donors, activists, volunteers, and allies to the cause of equality who have made our work possible." On September 16th, The Casper Star Tribune, the local paper in Matthew's hometown, published an editorial claiming that an award Jimenez had recently received for his book deserves rejection, saying, from the beginning, there have been those who want to ignore the sadistic homophobic motives of Shepherd's attackers and instead insist on the matter was a drug deal gone bad. The debate will no doubt rage on. Matthew Shepherd's murder will always be, for some, a symbol of the hatred many lesbians and gay men face in the U.S. and beyond. The town of Laramie can take some comfort from reacting with such dignity and humanity in the aftermath, and lending its name to the Laramie Project, which has changed hearts and minds. But the mystery remains, not so much why Matthew died, but why the gay community, after almost 5 decades of campaigning for equal rights, relies so fundamentally on the image of a perfect martyr to represent the cause. And when you think about it, though, like, it would work better for them to use him as he is. A poster boy for hiding from the rest of the world for so long, and then coming out to the world as openly gay, and the scene at the time, it was a lot of drugs in the bars.
It was.
And getting sucked into that as someone who comes out as gay, and not being able to navigate through that world without getting lost in, like I said, like, the only way to call it nicely was the scene.
It reminds me a lot of it was a movie that was adapted around a real life thing, Party Monster. And it had Seth Green and Macaulay Culkin in it? I think it had Macaulay Culkin in it, about a gay guy who stays in the closet until he ends up going to New York and finding the clubbing scene. And they start doing drugs and sleeping together and end up accidentally killing one of their friends. And, like, it reminds me heavily of that. But at the same time, I'm really torn on this one. The way that he died was not good. It was not good at all.
No, it wasn't. And
we're talking about a guy who had crimes against children. I immediately, like, shut down. Like, anything that involves kids, you can be... I'm very LGBT. I'm a big ally. But the minute you involve children is when that crosses a line. And I can no longer support you.
Yeah, and it's just, it was the manner of his death. A lot of people say that's why they said it was a hate crime. And then other people are saying, you know, these are men who are addicts. They're coming down. They need that high. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows addicts who are searching for a high will kill for it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Easily.
And so it's like, there was a lot more to his death than just being gay.
No, and exactly. And he wasn't killed because he was gay. I mean, it did open the doorway for the rest of, you know, the LGBT community. And I'm very thankful that we have those laws. And I am thankful on that. Because, you know, at least now my friends are not afraid to come out and hide. You know, I have family who have come to me to tell me that I'm the only person that they've come out to because they're too scared to tell anybody else. But they know they can trust me with that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that happened to me in high school too. And it's like, even in this day and age, people are still scared. And even after Matt's death, it, like, has become a lot safer. Mm-hmm. It's still scary for a lot of people. And
I mean, look at the trans community. Look how many people are murdered just because of the fact that they're trans.
Yeah.
There's a reason why people don't come forward with it. I mean,
and that's why I did want to do this story this time, because it does open up that conversation. Yes. For people. It does shed light on a lot of bad things that have happened in the communities and how homophobes and transphobes treat people who are mm-hmm. different than them. And
but we're all different. We're all different in our own ways.
And I'm also thinking that because, and related to this case, how Matthew and the assailant were related, and the hand marks on Matthew's genitals and the kicking him in the genitals. I'm wondering if they also didn't find out that he had AIDS.
Yeah.
And this is someone who's had sexual relationships with him.
Exactly.
So
that was the other thing that came to my mind too.
Yeah, so I'm thinking drugs didn't help matters. AIDS didn't help matters.
It was a whole hodgepodge of things.
Yeah. And so this is like a really interesting case. And like I said, this one is one I started learning about in middle school. And we watched videos of the protests. We watched videos. We watched the vigils. We saw pictures of the crime scene. We saw pictures of him beaten. We saw a lot of stuff. And, you know, at the time, I was like, why are they showing us this? And, like, looking back on it now, it's like, they really should.
Mm-hmm.
They should have. Because I never really thought about it before that. Like, I had one of my friends who was dating my god sister at the time, and he's like, I don't think I like her. I don't think I like women.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, and this was like the next year after that,
mm-hmm.
eighth grade. And I was just looking at him, I was like, we learned about this.
Mm-hmm.
You learned how to be kind to those who are experimenting or wanting to experiment and
find figuring out who
they are. And if I hadn't have like sat through that and seen what happens to people who are discriminated against, I could have very well gone with my other stepdad, my mom's ex-husband, who was incredibly Catholic and incredibly cruel,
mm-hmm.
to members of the LGBT.
And women.
He's just a horrible person. And my first encounter was, like, in fourth grade with our neighbor across the street, Holly. And then she went away. This is another example. She went away to rehab for a year.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't go to rehab. She was transitioning. She went to a different country. And she had to transition in a different country.
Yeah.
And after she was done with all the procedures and healing, she came back no longer Holly.
Mm-hmm.
She became a he. And when my father found out, he lost it. Mm-hmm. He was like, he would turn red and like literally red, and he would start spitting while he was yelling and screaming and cursing him out. And I was just sitting there and I'm like, that's still our same neighbor.
Yeah.
Like,
their pronouns are different. That's all.
The only thing different is their pronoun. Well, I guess their body's different.
Well, yeah, but we don't have anything to do with their bodies. Like,
yes. And you know,
are he's we still sleeping
going
with them?
Around the neighborhood shoveling people's sidewalks? He's still exactly. helping the elderly community in the apartment complexes behind us. He's a great person. And, you know, it's just very upsetting how people are still treated to this day and age. And
that's
why, like, I wanted to do this one. I wanted to bring more light to it. You know, get the word out there as much as you can. Originally, I was going to save this one for Pride Week, but I was thinking about it, and I was discussing it with my father-in-law, like, last week, and I was like, you know what? Why not?
Mm-hmm.
And this is just, it's one of those ones. I've got a lot of gay friends, I've got a lot of trans friends, I've got drag queens for friends, and I'm bisexual, and it's like,
yeah,
you know, this
more people are LGB than you realize.
Yeah, this shouldn't be an ongoing issue anymore. No. So this is,
as long as we are all consenting adults,
yeah,
that's all that matters. Like,
emphasis on that adult part, guys.
Exactly. emphasis on that.
There's a lot of issues still with that, too. So
oh, yeah.
Emphasis on adult guys.
All right, we should probably wrap it up, though.
Yep.
All right. Okay, so yeah, it's a deep episode. I was trying to go for the shock value, and you, like, never mind.
I hit y'all with a bat. Here you go. Here's a good dose of reality.
Okay. We got the Facebook page and the Instagram and the Twitter. All things that go bump in the night podcast. And yeah, you guys have a wonderful week, everybody.
Let everything we talked about sink in.
Exactly.
let us know what you think about the episode, and y'all have a great week, a great month, a great day, great everything.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everybody.